The Loose Cannons Podcast is a free-form discussion about film that contains mature language,
such as poop and titty,
and descriptions of mature situations,
such as filing taxes and raising children.
We do not have any concern for spoilers, so if you haven't seen the film or films we are discussing and don't want to have the twists ruined for you, please watch the film before listening to the podcast.
È lontano?
Tu vienimi dietro. Come già hai detto che ti chiami?
Gesummina.
Ma cosa mi conti? Che nome è?
È il nome di Gesù.
Ma Gesù era un uomo.
Non era né uomo né femmina, babbalone. Era uno che comandava tutti.
Ma va là, terra da pepe, terra nera.
Né un rechista di terra che non ci sta mai soli.
Hey everyone, it's another unseen European Criterion Collection Loose Cannons podcast coming at ya.
Yeah.
What up, Paul?
Today we're discussing 1963's The Organizer, directed by Mario Monicelli. Joining me, Ruben, today in discussing that film is Patrick.
Yep, right here next to you.
My flatmate has just butted his way into my podcast. It's like, what are you doing?
Hey, what's going on? I'm just going to hang out on the couch right here.
And Basil?
Yeah.
No Ilya, no guest. Sorry, Ilya / guest lovers.
Yep.
Which
back,
is...
Back to the original three.
Us. Yeah, we love Ilya.
We love them.
We love guests.
And sometimes guests.
Burn. Invisible burn.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't know who it's a burn of. But before we do that, let's do this. This little segment we like to call Heralds and Denouncements.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Patrick.
That's good. I haven't really watched too much since the last podcast we did, but... I think I have a sneaking suspicion the movie that you're going to...
Nope.
Okay. I don't know the movie that you're going to talk about. I guess I'm going to talk about My Best Friend's Wedding, which I watched here in this room with Ruben, and it was very funny, and it's very funny how they made Julia Roberts the bad guy in that movie. Uh-huh. Pretty explicitly acknowledge it. And I was like, wow. This is cool. This is a cool reversal of the usual people with symmetrical faces need to be together because mm-hmm. the person that they're going to marry is awful. It's like, nope. Cameron Diaz is pretty great at that movie. She drives real fast and sings real poorly and is very funny about it. And has a great, you know, like speech where she like tells Julia Roberts off and all the women at Comiskey Park are cheering for her.
In the bathroom.
I like when she calls her a big-haired.
It's the one safe
critic.
Space that remains for women.
Yep.
It's the Comiskey Park women's bathroom.
Yep. But that's a good. It's a good movie. It's very funny, and I really like the ending of it too.
Yeah.
Where George says, "There will be dancing." I was like, "Yeah."
The end of it.
Hell yeah.
I like the whole third act. Yeah. Basically, mm-hmm. everything starting from when she confesses her love for Michael through to the end, I think is all very well done. Something that I realized about the movie that's really good but also kind of sad is that I don't think the movie would work gender swapped because men would just identify with the Julianne character. They wouldn't get the criticism. Like, it had to be delivered in this fashion in order for men to like recognize it, and then of course they didn't see it. Because it's a rom-com.
For ladies.
Of course, yeah.
Women.
But,
they would just be like, why didn't he end up with her?
He did everything right.
Yeah, my uncle's, girlfriend, that's how she felt watching the movie back in 97. She's like, but I wanted them to end up together. I was like, that's not exactly what the point of that was.
I haven't updated my lists in a while. I really should, but I kind of want to add, what's his name?
Dermot Mulroney?
No. The other one? Guy.
Rupert Everett.
Rupert Everett, is that his name? That was the name that popped into my head, but for some reason I thought it was wrong. To my best supporting actor.
Yeah, list of the 90s.
I really like the way that like during the big chase sequence she's on the phone with him.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, but who's chasing you, Jules?
Yeah, that's my favorite line in the whole movie. I also love the way that he sets up the song when he's singing and he's telling that ludicrous story about meeting in a mental hospital.
Right.
And then he's like, I don't even remember, but it's totally, if you don't know it's coming, he lands the line perfectly where he's like, you know, he's like, and then I said to Jules, from the moment I wake up, when I put on my makeup.
I believe they're Dionne Warwick.
Yeah.
Very good.
Cool, dude. I mean, I like all the performances in it, but I think it's my favorite.
Yeah. They're all very good.
Yeah, from what I remember, that
like the weird dad.
From what I remember, that movie really brought Dionne Warwick back too, as far as like music in the '90s. Like I remember a bunch of people singing Dionne Warwick songs, and I was like, "Where did these songs come from? Why is everybody interested in them all of a sudden? They seem really old."
My best Dionne Warwick reunion.
Yep. Once you get the lobster hands guy dancing, everyone's on board.
Yeah. All right. Anything else?
Yep, that's all I want to say.
Basil.
All right, I'm going to herald Minnie and Moskowitz. More Cassavetes. Finally got around to this one after weeks of Haley and I trying to watch it. It's an extremely unhinged movie. It's a lot of yelling, a lot of strange comical yelling. One of the best scenes in the movie, Gina Rowlands. Her friend sets her up on a date. And this guy's name is Zelmo, and he's like a sad guy, and he's just yelling the whole date, even when, and then also telling her how she is when she's not talking to him. She's like, he's like, oh, I can see you're a good listener. You know, people talk too much these days. Like, I can tell you're a good listener. Look, you're very beautiful, you know that? Just saying stuff like that to her. The whole date, and then she tries to end the date very politely, being like, you know, I'm having nice time at lunch with you, but I'm not interested in anything romantic. And then he flips out on her, and I was like, whoa, this is pretty 1971. Cassavetes already knew how gross men are when you try to say no to them, even if you say it nicely. It's pretty grim, but yeah, it's a funny, strange movie. People have likened it to a screwball comedy, and I guess it is that, in that it's like very energetic, and there's a lot of very funny stuff he does with editing, and also just the characters are kind of over the top in general, but it's also so angry. It's very uncomfortable to watch, and really cool. Cassavetes is a great guy. He never did anything wrong.
About to take a sip of my coffee and read a Wikipedia article about John Cassavetes. Yeah, you didn't know what movie I was going to talk about, because I'm not going to talk about any movie.
Yeah.
I watched half of The Life Aquatic of Steve Zissou, which was fine, but I got bored. I got sleepy, and then I was like, I don't really want to finish watching this. I rewatched My Best Friend's Wedding, which I still think is great, but has already been canonized and heralded by me, so and now heralded by you, too. Yeah. And I watched Ant-Man and the Wasp, which I'm on Radio Silence about, so.
Oh, boyo. Yeah.
Fair enough.
I rewatched Point Break as well, although that was before the last podcast. And again, that movie has also been heralded by me and canonized.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Also a good one. I mean, what did you talk about Ball of Fire last time?
Yeah, we can herald your
Uncle Joe.
Just gonna catalog all the movies that we've watched in our apartment so far. Mm-hmm. Heralding the.
Yeah, you should start your own letterboxed list.
Yeah, we'll throw out a herald for the cleaning people who came earlier and cleaned our apartment. That was good.
Yeah.
And finally cleaned herald up that shower.
Herald your Nerf poster.
Herald this. This is a really cool poster that I got on eBay. And the other cool posters that I got on justseats.org, if anybody's interested. Really cool posters on there.
Yeah, get posters, people.
Yeah.
I need some. I have one. Should put it up.
Is it Black Hat?
No. Well, I have all those posters, but they're still at Ashley's place where I used to live. Oh. And I keep forgetting to get them from her, along with all my books. She has literally all my books, but and a bunch of my DVDs. So at some point, I will do that, but probably never at this point. That some point is never. Because it's been...
Enjoy my stuff, Ashley.
Yeah, I mean, it's been...
That's communism.
Over 2 years at this point of her having my stuff, and I still haven't got it. Is one of the great things about not owning a car. She has a car, but I never remember that she has a car until we're hanging out, and I was like, oh yeah, I should ask you to put like a few of my books. Like if you brought a few of my books every time we hung out, I'd have them all back by now. But
if I had a few books for every time we hung out,
I'd have my possessions again. Mm-hmm. All right, let's discuss this movie. This was Patrick's pick, I believe, right?
Yep,
so
it sure was.
Patrick, tell us what happens in The Organizer.
All right, well, starts in a factory town in Turin, Italy, and the workers there...
No horses.
Yeah, the worker... No horses.
No, there's some horses.
Oh, there are some horses at the end of the movie, yes. The army rides in on horses, but mostly it's about the workers at this factory. They're pretty overworked and they're not really happy with the working conditions, and then one day a older worker gets his hand lopped off by a machine and everybody's trying to take up a collection for him, and they realize that the reason that he got his hand lopped off is because he was too tired from working a 14-hour shift. So they basically decide that they're going to organize and call a workout, or a walkout early from work one day, but they kind of botch the attempt. And everybody kind of gets mad at the guy who was supposed to ring the bell and everyone was supposed to walk out. But while they're fighting, Marcello Mastroianni's character shows up, and he is a professor and he's an organizer, and he basically gets them together and helps them organize a real strike so that they can fight for it's kind of funny how small their concessions are, but like a 13-hour workday, and not to have to pay the fines for trying to work out early, and a couple of other like small things like that. But it's basically about him trying to keep the strike going. They have a battle with some scabs at one point. There's a big confrontation at the end, or they try to arrest him at one point. They try to send the police after him, and there's a little bit of intrigue and infighting. There's a big confrontation at the end where the army ends up shooting into a crowd and someone gets killed. But the workers eventually win their... I think they win. It's actually not made explicitly clear if they win all of their demands, but the ending seems upbeat enough that I think it's implying that they won the demands they were trying to get from the factory.
Tough to talk about. I guess I'm going first, right?
Dazzle.
I didn't really like this movie. I liked some of the shots a lot, but something about the editing I found a little distracting. It felt like often shots would like cut in what felt like the middle of the shot, like the shot was supposed to go on for like a beat or two, and then it just didn't. And there's like some strange POV stuff that doesn't make any sense to me, where it's like cutting from someone looking and then like the angle doesn't make any sense to be from where they're looking from, and a few like aesthetic things like that that I was kind of confused about. And then I didn't know how I felt about everything. It was like a movie that I was like on board with all the ideas, but somehow the execution for it fell pretty flat for me. I thought that, I mean, even down to like the way that Mastroianni like sort of sticks out, because he's like a famous actor and everyone else kind of looks like character actors, and then they light him like a Hollywood movie star, and I was like, this movie's about like working class solidarity while also like aesthetically privileging like the most famous person in the movie, and I feel a little weird about that. But yeah, so we can get into more specifics as we talk about it, but I was kind of bored a little bit of the time.
I like this movie a lot. The only thing that I could say is like a really strong complaint is that it feels like it's doing that awful thing where the, you know, most morally corrupt person is physically corrupt as well. So the big boss is in a wheelchair, and it seems like a very pointed ableist commentary that disgusts me. But otherwise, I mostly like the film.
It's like, what is it? Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah.
Capitalism is debilitating. Not just mentally, physically.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get into another long discussion about Once Upon a Time in the West, but I don't know if I would agree with that reading of that film. But something that I liked about his appearance is that we spend the first 40 or so minutes before he appears, or an hour maybe, in this kind of slum-like town. And these are the only conditions when we see, and when it abruptly cuts to his daughter or nieces or whatever party where she's playing with the piano, the pinata, it's such a striking display of wealth and opulence after watching so much degradation that it's like almost insulting in a way that I like. I was like, ugh, I don't want to look at this. I hate this party. And it's just like, whatever, it's just a party. Like, that girl didn't do anything, but like, to me, that moment really worked.
Yeah, their house, the like weird like factory housing that they live in, it just looks like a weird prison. It's just like shaped like a U. It's just like a huge tall building.
I also like this movie, and I think it did something kind of interesting with building the character of the organizer himself. I forget what his name is. What is his name in the movie? It's like
Professor.
Yeah, it's the professor. Yeah,
being a dog.
The professor. Sinigaglia. Sinigaglia. That's his name. But he's not really that good a guy. Like, he's kind of an asshole, and he's really patronizing towards Maria, who's the, I guess, the main. I guess you could call her a love interest, but not really. I mean, she's a, I don't know, she's a prostitute who's basically like, kind of his love interest, although it's more like she's just like, you can stay here while the police are looking for you kind of thing. But he's really like,
that would be one of my minor complaints, is that they just sort of throw that in at the end, and it seems like maybe the like a producer's note, they're like,
needs to be sexy or something like that.
We need to make it, you know, internationally viable. It's got to have a love angle and some sex.
A little bit racy.
A little bit of sex.
Yeah. With a little bit of sex in it. But I think that for some reason it feels pointed, his thing that he says to her, where he's like, someday women like you won't have to do what you do, or something like that. She just kind of like looks at him like, whatever, dude. Like, she doesn't really care that she does what she does. Like, it's almost like he's being kind of white knightish in a way. It's like, you're just kind of being a dick about, you know, like how you don't have to do what I do for a living because society doesn't dictate that.
Yeah, what he's really saying is like, someday you will only have sex with me instead of other people.
Yeah.
I would prefer that.
That's the society for me.
Yeah, but I mean, and he's not even really like particularly good at leading people, like, especially when they have the scabs. Like, he just kind of bungles that whole thing, and the scabs kind of ignore him when he tries to talk to them, and it just ends up in this huge free-for-all. But like, it does show the one place where he kind of has it up on everybody else is like, he can get up on a podium and just like really give it to everybody on this, in his speeches, and get everybody excited. And it's like, okay, like, this guy kind of has his place too. Like, even though he's kind of a bungler the rest of the time, and he's, you know, kind of cowardly and whatnot, and he just kind of runs, you know, he spends most of the movie just running away. Like, when he gets up on the podium, he can really rally everyone else, who is...
He's the Mussolini for the left. He gives some good speeches, and he does nothing else.
Yeah. Yeah, and everybody else is really the, you know, like, there's another character who's sort of the muscle of the group, who's, you know, the one who really, you know, he ends up dying because he gets hit by a train, but he like, you know, is the one who's actually doing the most in the fight with the scabs, and, you know, he's the one that the police are probably actually afraid of, and... It's just, it's like everybody else does something better than him until he gets up on that podium, and then it's like, okay, this is the one thing that he does well, and I kind of liked that he's not just, like, all everything to everyone. He's just kind of like, he has his specific spot, and that basically is, you know, just rallying people.
Mm-hmm. Then he's hungry.
Yeah.
Never has enough food. Poor guy.
I didn't want to, like, argue with you while you were saying your what you disliked about the film, but I actually think it's one of the things that works for me, is that, like, the first, when he shows up, like, his beard is, like, not totally real or something, and, like, I'm like...
Yeah, I noticed that, too.
And, like, as soon as, like, he appears in the train, it's, like, from far away, I'm like, I know him, I know that guy. He, like, stands out in a way, like, that's kind of awkward, and, in fact, the guy who's sort of... his clearest foil, in a way, the person who he's bunking with, Raul,
yeah.
Like, explicitly says to him, like, you're not one of us. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
you showed up.
Yeah, I
like
that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sorry.
You showed up, you have these ideas, and maybe they're helpful, but, like, you don't understand our struggle and what we're going through. We're, like, an experiment to you. And I was like, reminds me of a very certain specific group of leftists who exist right now and have more popular podcasts than us.
I like that moment until, because I don't know, like, it was hard for me to tell whether or not, like, it was the director or, like, you know, like, stars have, like, a certain amount of power, but, like, I feel like that moment lands really well until Mastroianni starts talking, and then it's kind of like this self-pitying thing where I feel like you're supposed to feel bad about him, because it's like, oh, you're right, I don't have this thing, but what else do I not have? Family or friends? My life is sad. And it's like, okay, like, I was on board for you being called out, but now it's like you're turning it around on this guy, and I don't like that.
Yeah.
And I didn't think that the movie was necessarily being like, you know, like, he, like, calling him out in that moment as being self-pitying also. Like, I did feel like you were supposed to feel bad for
It ends him. Kind of gently, which I liked just because I like soft masculinity, where he tucks him in. Like, it made me laugh. I was like, aw.
Yeah, but I'll also say, like, what makes that moment actually land for me is that, like, later he admits to Maria that he does have a family, so he was just lying to that guy.
Oh, really?
To make him feel bad.
About
yeah,
I when he's
talking
part.
To Maria
That's
in the
funny.
Cafe, he says that he has a wife and two kids. So he's really just being an asshole again.
I mean, maybe he meant more metaphorically, since he can't go back to them. He's like a wanted man in Genoa or whatever, but
I guess.
Still, that's not how it reads in the moment, so that's
true.
A good point.
Yeah.
Yeah, what was I going to say?
Oh, I was also going to point out that it also does a, like, I guess, like, kind of a good job of showing that, like, even within the ranks of these working class people, like, there's still, like, stuff like racism going around, because there's the one guy, I think his name is Mustafa.
Oh, the Sicilian?
Yeah, who goes to work in the factory, and they, like, shout at him and call him a Bedouin.
Yeah.
While he's trying to walk into the factory, and I was like, ooh, yeah, like, these people are being really racist to this guy, and he's like, you know, he says that he's been there for, like, 12 days, and he doesn't have credit like everyone else has, and it's another thing where it's like, oh, well, you know, he has a different struggle than you guys have, and, you know, there are layers
should acknowledge
to this.
It. Yeah. Intersectionality.
Yeah.
This movie was on top of it before that word existed.
when they have the first meeting about organizing, a similar thing happens where, like, the women try to add their input, and they're like, oh, do you think they'll listen to women or something like that? And I, of course, made a classic Bernie Bros joke. And I was like, who invited Bernie Bros to this communist meeting?
Women rightly point out, like, we do the labor, too. Like, we're out there working the machines also.
It's true.
Women are comrades.
Yes.
I was interested in your read, Patrick. I meant to bring it up earlier because I actually read the ending the opposite way because it ends like with the organizer gets arrested and then Raul has to leave town because he's a wanted man now. So I thought that they were all just like, well, we've lost our collective will and now we're just going back to work like normal, all that work and. All it takes is you kill somebody and then you're the strong arm of capitalism.
I read it as kind of when he's leaving and the upbeat music is playing and she's like, write to me, being like, they have this optimism, this hope that they're gonna find a different situation someplace else, but that there is no different situation somewhere else, that he's going to do what the professor did, which is leave his family behind and go try to help someplace else, but fail.
And that, the kind of collectivized singing that opens the movie is, ironically used as the end credits thing. And I was like, that's dark.
Yeah. It's I thought grim. The ending was pretty upsetting.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. I saw it as more of I don't know, it seemed to me like if there was a situation where the army, it seemed like the army captain kind of lost his head and wasn't supposed to order them to fire into the crowd like that, because the soldiers start fighting amongst themselves even after that,
Because one of that guy, that soldier's engaged to that little kid's older sister or whatever, but...
I don't know, maybe I read it wrong, it's never explicitly said what happened, but I think maybe that reading works as well.
It's nicer.
Yeah.
It's more optimistic.
We like that reading. Socialism will win.
Yep.
Sometimes you say it even
projecting
when you don't
a little bit
it.
There. I'm like, I want them to win.
Come on.
They just wanted one hour the 60s. Off, guys. Come on.
What I've read about the 60s in Italy, it was an extremely grim time. I mean, I guess Antonioni's movies bear that out, but they had a really horrible financial collapse, and then similar to our 2008 collapse, they recovered very quickly by the rich people getting super rich all of a sudden, but everyone else was still very poor. So I think that this period in Italian history, people were not optimistic about the idea of social mobility, things getting better.
Yeah.
But, what's he gonna say? Damn it, I lost it.
Okay, I really like the portrayal of the military since we started talking about that. When they show up, it's kind of like a Starship Troopers moment. They're all 17 years old. And it's this is depressing. It's depressing for two reasons. One, that they're that they're children. And two, that this is a very smart, subtle recognition that all of the adults of that generation died.
Yeah.
10 years ago.
Yeah.
In the horrible war that happened.
I didn't even think about that. You're right.
There are no men. Yeah, there are no captains or generals left because they all died. There's no one to advance the ranks in the military.
Yeah, the captain looks like he's 21 years old.
Yeah, the soldiers are 17. He's advanced the top rank because he can drink legally.
I think the drinking is in Italy, but
But then that's contrasted with the business people who are all super old.
Yeah.
Who are super old. And the factory workers, too, who are like...
And they all survived the war just fine. I remember what I was going to say now. This movie reminded me that... that, like, it seems interesting to me that, you know, like, factory housing and stuff like that, like, things like that aren't really a thing, and they totally were in the early days of, like, urban industrialization. And I feel like that's on purpose because it's so much easier to organize if you just, like, live with all your coworkers. Mm-hmm. Just like, hey, everybody, let's get together and be like, fuck this working environment. Like, we should fix this.
Yeah.
But if you, like, you know, dispersed among the urban place and various rentals, then it's much harder to organize. And similar things with, like, the credit thing or whatever. Like, credit's outsourced to big companies that can just come after you now.
Yeah.
As opposed to, like, your local grocery, you could be like, oh, I'm going to buy a bunch of groceries because we're about to go on strike. But now if you, like, buy a bunch of groceries because you're supposed to go on strike, or if you're like, I'm going to go on strike so I can't pay my rent, like, if you're on strike and you live in housing owned by the factory that you're striking from, like, they can't also kick you out of that because that's, like, part of the strike. But, like, if you're renting from an entirely different company, they can be like, oh, that's cool that you're striking. You're evicted. And then you're just homeless.
Yeah.
So it's cool ways that capitalism has dispersed people so as to make it harder to, you know,
to organize,
take collective action.
Yeah, and it's trading, like, minor freedoms, like minor choices for loss of a much bigger freedom and choice. Yep. So, like, you get to choose.
Yeah, I can live wherever I want.
Yeah.
Yep.
But they defer all of the costs onto you. And it's like, well, is that really worth it?
Yeah.
And the answer is no.
Not at all. My rent's very expensive.
And, yeah, and of course, that's, like, also responsible for, like, white flight and stuff like that. Like, yeah, these people are racist, and that's horrible, and it's something that the left in general needs to work on, like, every group in this racist world. But, like, they have the possibility for, like, those other people visit his house and they see his conditions and they're like, oh, we're gonna let him work, we're gonna raise money for him so that he could survive. Like, the possibility of them not becoming racist, like, exists because he's part of their world in a way in which people who run away to the suburbs, they can't not become racist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's also, like, in some ways a commentary that exists within, or maybe not even intended, but in blue collar that we talked about before, because, like, they're all blue collar factory workers, but they also all own their own houses, so they're, like, separated by the, you know, suburbanized contemporary, like, post-50s world. And
yeah.
Again, that makes it harder than if you all just live together to collectivize.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so
rough
weird
stuff
to me that, like, any kind of collectivization has been demonized so much in the United States. Like, that's kind of part of the propaganda. It's like, oh, no, you want to live in a house with another person. Like, that would be terrible. You wouldn't have your own space. Like, you wouldn't have all your own things and get to be your own person.
Yeah, I've seen actual, like, you know, licensed psychologists say that, like, it's good for the psyche to move out of your parents' home. It's good for both of you to establish this independent relationship. And I'm like, so all those other countries in the world where people just live with their families forever, everyone there is just terrible. They're all just failing.
Yeah, they're all wrong.
Yeah, the people in the Middle East who live with their families growing up, people in East Asian countries who live together, people in Italy, Greece, they're just stupid.
Yeah, they are. It's American psychology, it's one of the hardest and most accurate sciences, so must be right.
I don't think these people have any research backing up their conclusions.
Oh,
I
know.
They're just making shit up and using their
with research
to push it.
Yeah,
that's
fun. I read plenty of fun articles about, you know, the replication crisis.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny. It exists even in the hardest sciences. People
sure does.
Like, oh, I discovered this thing. And it's like, oh, that's cool. I tried the exact same experiment and it didn't work. But
the biggest problem with the replication crisis is that someone says, whoa, this thing is really interesting. We should do another experiment to test and make sure it's true. And they said, oh, but they already proved that. Why would we give you money to do it again?
Right.
So they don't even get to do it a second time. They don't even get to try and fail.
Yeah, I read some fun stuff recently about the Stanford Prison Experiment, which is obviously, like, a bogus experiment, but that is pretty cool, because I guess someone finally did get money to redo it in, I think, the late 2000s, and they actually found the opposite to be true. Instead of the guards being really malicious, like, the prisoners all, like, really collectivized and, like, strong-armed the guards into getting, like, a bunch of concessions.
That's awesome.
Yeah, because, yeah, one of the flaws in that experiment, for anyone listening who doesn't know, is that the guy who played the head guard had tried previous experiments before. He was, like, a PhD student, and so he just took all his own ideas that he'd had about how to be a really terrible guard and fed them to the rest of the guards, but then the guy, I forget his name, the doctor who presented it Milgram? As if the guards had come up with them. No, Zambroni or something like that. I forget his name. It starts with a Z. But yeah, he presented his findings as if the guards had come up with all these rules and things spontaneously, like they had just assumed the role of a guard and been like, I'm a guard now, what do I do to, like, keep these prisoners in line? But really it was like a guy giving them information and being like, we should do this to them because then they'll be more compliant. And they're like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, I mean, that's the other thing, that's why this is off topic, but why it's like a bullshit experiment. Multiple people have just been like, well, I was a college student getting paid to play a role. I thought it was an acting role, so I was just like, well, I'm playing a guard, I should act like a prison guard. That's what prison guards do. Like, rather than, so it's like, rather than just inhabiting a role, they just think of themselves as giving a performance because they want the professor to think they did a good job.
Yeah. That's one of the most common type of biases in psychological experiments, is if the person having an experiment done on them figures out what you want, they will give it to you.
Right.
Every time. Yep. That's why you have to use always some sort of deception.
Mm-hmm.
So that they don't know what they're actually being tested for or about.
For sure. Yeah, I mean, it's the same with the electrical one.
Yeah.
Like, I'm supposed to turn this all the way because you just told me to, and I don't believe this university is going to murder a person. I really don't.
Yeah, but also they found, like, when people were directly told to do it, they wouldn't do it. They would only do it when they would be, like, kind of, like, sideways telling them to do it. Like, they were like, soft selling them on the idea of telling to do it. They'd be like, oh, well, just, you know, just kind of keep going. I mean, I guess we have to or whatever, like something like that. But when they were like, you have to do it, people would be like, no.
What are we doing?
That's interesting. So anyway. Some of the things about that experiment seem fairly reasonable conclusions, mm-hmm. though. Like, they did different tests with, like, where the victim was and, like, mm-hmm. where the and where the teacher, that's the person who was telling them what to do, was. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And essentially, the closer the teacher is and the further away the victim is, the more likely they are to shock the person, which
right.
makes absolute sense with the way that people act.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, like, even though I was shitting on both of them, the Stanford one is, like, a much more methodologically unsound one. They actually did do lots of different kinds of ways of testing the shocking one. So, at least as far as methodology goes, they were doing their due diligence. Anyway, that's a cool digression.
Back to the organizer. I really did get a good sense of where Bellatar's aesthetic comes from in this movie, though, watching this, because I was like, man, he really loves those shots of, like, lots of people walking somewhere. Because you see that in Werkmeister Harmoniak in particular. Like, there's a lot of that where people are walking down this, like, muddy streets in this, like, factory town. And it looks really cool. I haven't seen Satan Tango, but I hear that there's also something very similar in Satan Tango where someone's walking down the street like that.
Yeah, I did like the kind of, like, staging in focus. That was one of the things that I liked a lot, but then that was, like, one of the things that was semi-annoying to me, that whatever thing about the editing was distracting me, but especially, like, the factory stuff, I was like, oh, this is, like the factory worker version of Billy Wilder in Double Indemnity or The Apartment,
yeah.
Where it's, like, it's so long, like, really haunting mechanical shot of, like, people working. It's really creepy.
Yeah. And, like, the more, I guess, I think that's definitely true. And the more optimistic, positive way is, like, these are all part of, like, a larger story. Like, there's other people that we're not meeting or whatever that are in the background that are all part of this action.
Yeah, and I also like the scene where they're at the train yard stealing coal. And they're just throwing the coal over the fence.
Yeah.
And the woman climbs up over it. And it's a kind of a cool shot. You said it looked like a Jurassic Park.
Yeah,
where they climb
so much
over
like
the
Jurassic Park.
Electric
when they
fence.
Go over the fence.
But the woman climbs up over the fence and all these, like, coal rocks are just flying over her head. And it's like you're just people standing on train cars just, you know, lobbing large quantities of coal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought the movie looked super good. Super good looking movie. And I liked how the wide shots were typically more used for those communal spaces, like the factory or the gathering spaces. And then again, like when you went to the wealthy place, it was like maybe it was a wide shot, but there was always a wall in the way, so like you couldn't see what was beyond your very limited myopic vision.
Yeah,
and they're all hemmed in around like desks and stuff that.
Well,
like there's like
disease.
A lot of people in the frame, but they're all just like crowded around.
The offices are all very limiting in the space that they can see.
Yeah, there's something I wish I didn't know about Criterion, because when they do these restorations, sometimes they go overboard with the contrast, like, and I can't tell watching this movie, because I was like, oh, these blacks and whites really pop, but I was like, did the movie really look like that when people saw it in 63, or did somebody at Criterion be like, oh, this looks cool?
Yeah.
And,
the
like,
Instagram
that's, like,
should
on
have
my
a
mind
Criterion filter, because they have a very specific aesthetic and they make a lot of movies. Like, they, you know, when you're taking an old print, you have a range of acceptable values where you're like, it could have been anywhere between A and
right.
B. And we always choose the closest to B that we can do, because that's what gives us that classic Criterion look that we like. I think there are other reasons, but I think that's probably part of the reason why Vertigo became repopularized. I wonder if you compare it to, like, older, like, at the time, qualities, prints of Hitchcock films, people were just like, whoa, Vertigo looks insanely good. That's why we love it. The blacks are so crisp, everything. It's like, it's got these huge bright colors and like red or whatever. It's like, oh man, this is a super saturated, contrasty film.
Right.
Yeah. It makes you wonder.
It's like, we'll never
it's like
know.
Some
Speed Racer of the 80s.
Yeah, or like some print somewhere in like Indiana that's been, you know, like run to death that they get, and it's just all washed out. And it's like people probably watched that and were like, yeah, this one's not as good as, you know, Psycho or whatever.
And it's because, like, I mean, we can never know. Because, you know, like, someone who was alive and saw Vertigo when it first came out, that was, like, by the time they restored it, that's, like, 50 years later, they'd be like, oh, yeah, it totally did look like this when I saw it 50
Memory
years ago.
Memory's a lie.
I mean, it's the same with, well, I guess, like, Michael Mann's recoloring of the thief thing. It's kind of a bummer. It's like, I really wanted it to look like this, so now the movie looks like this, even though that wasn't how I looked when I made it.
It's a cool-looking movie, though. That Criterion filter really works.
Yeah, that's an interesting sort of, I guess, like, living history of cinema thing, where it's just like, oh, yeah, sometimes...
Like, everyone likes contrast and saturation.
No? Yeah, yeah, or you know, sometimes, like... movies get a weird shake because of something strange like that, where it's just like, oh yeah, they just changed it at a certain point and then it became popular again. It just completely changed. It's a different movie now.
Yeah, I was very distracted. I can't remember if I mentioned it on the Asian action one, but watching Godzilla, the contrast was like so intense. I was like, there's no way this like low budget movie looked like this one.
Yeah.
When it came out.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's way off topic, but it's one of the reasons why I'm so impressed with the movies Love and Anarchy and Somewhere, is because I think they're fairly low contrast, low saturation films, and yet they still look so good. It's like they didn't have to use cheat codes to...
Yeah, Somewhere looks amazing. I mean, Love and Anarchy too. I like the look of both of them, but, man, even Marie Antoinette, like, there's like...
It's like a haze on
kind
it.
Of
yeah.
Pastel, yeah.
It kind of changes over the course of the film. Like, I can't remember whether it starts off kind of hazy and then gets more, like, poppy. I think it does, yeah. Over the course of the film, it gets more, like, Malicky.
Right. Yes, it sure does. But, yeah, the beginning, cool. Like, when they're sitting at those huge dining tables, it's, like, so opulent, but also just kind of looks the same because all the colors
it's
are,
like, very flat.
Just, like, yeah, very small gradations of each other.
A small note about this movie of something that I liked is when the professor first shows up, he goes to see this other teacher teaching people how to read and write, and he's like, you gotta learn how to read and write so you can vote. And I was like, that's good to learn to read and write, but that's the wrong reason to do it. You need to change that law. That law is bad. And it reminded me of, like, a lot of, I guess, backwards, I guess, organizing. Or the, like, like, it would be different if he was like, we gotta learn to read and write so that we can vote to get this illegal, bad law replaced. Like,
yeah.
And it's just like the focus is just like slightly off, even if what he's doing is good. It's like he missed the point.
Close, but no potato.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although, yeah, I mean, it's the same with like the...
In that case, the Twitter account is highlighting people who are too stupid and they're making the the correct argument, but like ironically, like they don't get it.
Yeah.
Like that, God, what's his name? I don't remember. Maybe it was Cernovich who did it, who was like... if healthcare is right, why not housing?
Yeah,
why not
Joe
food?
Walsh. Yeah, Joe Walsh.
It's like, yeah, why not?
Yeah, like the Sean Hannity thing with Ocasio-Cortez, where it just showed like her platform. And it's like, look at all these terrible things, and it just sounds really good.
Yeah, it's like, hell it's yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, look, she wants to respect the elderly. Boop.
Yeah. Supports women. Who would do such a thing? But, what was I gonna say? Shit. A little spaced out today. Woke up at 6:45 in the morning.
Yeah, that's why we delayed the podcast, is because we had to wake up early, to let the people, the cleaning people
the cleaners,
in.
Yeah.
And then we had trouble getting
Wanted
back to
go
sleep.
Back to sleep. Yeah, that's fair.
Because they were loud. They were doing their job very well.
Too well, if you ask me.
Yeah, they did a good job.
We're not rich, by the way. Our apartment was a mess when we moved in. They paid to come and fix it.
Yeah. Yeah, in case you were wondering, listeners... They don't have cleaning people that come early in the morning and wake them up.
Yeah, we...
Every day?
We got this apartment from your brother, because your brother got a house.
Yeah, and they left it very messy.
And we're like, oh, it's cheap, but they didn't clean anything. My shower is still filled with cat litter. It's not now.
Ew.
It's not now, but they were... That was, they were using the bat, the, like, my bathroom is sort of the, it's the laundry room slash
so they had two bathrooms?
Yeah, there's two bathrooms.
One is the cat box. A cat toilet?
Shower. There's, like, plug the drain and just put the cat box on there.
This is the type of content people sign up for.
Yeah. You gotta know, man. Now I can finally take a shower in my own shower.
I mean, I hate to be predictive, but I would say, considering I only follow three people on Letterboxd who've watched this movie, this is probably going to be one of our least listened to episodes. Good thing we're having fun with
it. We recently got a request to, like, open up some of the older ones. In particular, the Barry Lyndon one is pretty popular. And nice. We start off that one, I think we talk for like 45 minutes or something, just playing games and stuff, not even talking about the movie.
Yeah, back when we used to rip off Doug Loves Movies.
And I was like, hell yeah.
I just sort of missed those days. The time, I thought we might have a popular podcast, so I was like, I don't know if it's the best way to do ripping off a much more popular podcast, but those games are really fun, so I do miss them.
Yeah.
You guys could do one of them yourself. Every time
that's
we did,
true.
It was me.
It's true, yeah. We'll come up with one.
Do more work, Ruben. You lazy bum. I want to play games.
Yeah. I like the scene where
Omira.
Assaults his younger brother because he's not going to school.
Oh, yeah. He says, I'll kill you if you end up like me. Which seems counterintuitive, I guess, but...
Well, he says, I want to be like you, I want to go to the factory, and certainly assaulting him is going to make him want to be like you less.
I suppose so.
One of the times when physical abuse is totally justified.
That was my point. Yeah. That's definitely the point I was making.
There we go.
It's a good alley-oop dunk scenario.
There you go. This hitting children never gives them any sort of complexes or fucks their lives up forever, you know.
But, that is what I was going to say. That's related to it. I really like the scene where the teacher yells at, like, the principal or, like, superintendent or whatever because he tries to take the money away that they're collecting, and he's like, I'm trying to teach them, like, the importance of, you know, socialism and... like sharing with people who have less than you, and they're like, no, we don't allow that sort of thing at this school. Yeah. Not anymore. And I was like, well, this is
another
interesting way in which the capitalism filters into everything, even things that you weren't you're supposed to think of as separated, like academics.
Yeah,
they're not. Spoiler.
It's another
cut to 2018.
It's another, like, old white-haired dude behind a desk too. He's like, no, you can't do that. that's basically the factory too.
So this is a kind of funny, but also very frightening story from my childhood that I didn't really know, but was retold recently. But apparently, when I was younger, during the election year for George H.W. Bush Senior, you know, the school had, like, people dress up as George Bush and Michael Dukakis and go to each class, and then, like, the students would, like, write down their votes and, you know, put in a secret ballot.
Jesus.
And I mean, we haven't gotten to the creepy part yet. I was the only person in the school who voted for Michael Dukakis. And even though it was supposed to be a secret ballot, apparently my teacher asked me why I did that.
Whoa.
This is where it starts. That's creepy point number one. And apparently I responded, George Bush is a criminal and Dan Quayle is an idiot. And so then she called a parent-teacher meeting with my parents to talk about this, which is not okay. You're not allowed to question a child's political leanings for not going along with the crowd. Like, that's deeply unsettling.
Very.
Apparently, my parents were like, oh, I don't know where he heard that. But, you know, I was just saying what they said.
Yeah.
Was that 100% what they said?
Also,
yeah, of course.
On television, probably.
Yeah.
On the news.
Yeah, Dan Quayle was an idiot, was everywhere. I think probably George Bush is a criminal was something that my mom said.
Nah.
You know, Iran-Contra happened, guys.
Yeah. He was a criminal. Yeah. All presidents are criminals. It's an inescapable fact of running a criminal society. Yep. If Bernie Sanders had won, he would be a slightly less bad criminal than the one we have in office. Yep. Maybe significantly less bad, but he'd still be a criminal.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So, yeah, it's like Nixon said, it's not illegal if the President of the United States does it.
One of the worst criminals.
He definitely wasn't a criminal.
Someone who was a criminal before he ran for office and wanted to become more and stronger and better criminal.
He even told us he wasn't a criminal. He was so not a criminal. He had to tell us about it, guys.
Peace, guys.
I think that's it for my notes on the organizer.
Oh, yeah. I was just going to say the peace symbol seems especially ironic coming from Nixon.
Yeah. All that Vietnam.
Yeah, and that too.
He may be the only Republican who hated hippies more than black people.
But he also hated black people.
Yeah, he did.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Even a large amount? Yeah. Oh, he hated... Oh, I see. I thought you were saying black people hate hippies, I didn't know that was a stereotype about black people.
His hatred of hippies
Republicans,
was greater than his hatred of black
all
people.
All hate hippies and black people. He may be the only Republican who actually hated hippies more than black people.
That's fair.
Yes.
But no, he sure hated black people.
Nope. Yeah, he did.
He ran on that law and order platform, which was just
Dixiecrat.
Give the police extra powers so that they can, you know, harass black people and murder them without consequences.
And gay people.
Oh yeah, just anyone who didn't
trans
fit,
people.
Yeah, anyone who didn't
poor
fit
people.
The mold.
Oh yeah, that reminds me. There's a customer that comes into my work every once in a while. He's very nice, but he was like in Stonewall, like he was there, and I was like, well, that's cool. And he told me some stories about it, and then every time he comes into the work he tells me I should get that Stonewall movie, like the one that what's his name did,
whitewashed and transwashed.
The Roland Emmerich Stonewall.
Yeah exactly. And I was like, I'm not sure why, as a person who was actually there, you want us to screen that movie. I mean, I'm glad the history is important to you, but...
Has he seen it? Does he know?
I don't know. I'm always afraid to ask, because I'm just like... He's like, yeah, are you guys going to get that Stonewall movie soon? And I was like... I don't really make these decisions.
Probably
he seems very impassioned about it every time.
Maybe he's talking about a different Stonewall movie.
Maybe there's
some
documentary.
Yeah, maybe there's a cool documentary. Yeah.
Ask him next time.
That would be cool.
Like, what year did it come out? Who directed it?
Ask him if he means the documentary by that trans woman.
There you go.
What was that one called?
Remember. I don't remember what that one is.
She was
called.
Very mad at David A. France.
Oh, yeah. Stole a bunch of her research stuff for the one about Marsha Johnson.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thanks.
Oof. Mm-hmm. Oof. Ouch. Bad times. Bad times.
One of the many movies at my montage that I now feel conflicted about.
Yeah, it's sad because How to Survive a Plague is a very good movie from what I remember, and now I'm like, well,
maybe he stole it.
Maybe
he stole a very good movie.
He stole some of that stuff. That's unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, maybe this person should just be more like Abbie Hoffman. Be like, yeah, steal my movie.
yeah. I've the way that I've worked it out with Quentin Tarantino now, as I've just decided that every film of his that I like, the actor is the auteur. So, Django is Jamie Foxx as auteur. Inglourious Basterds is Brad Pitt as auteur.
And Melanie Laurent.
Kill Bill Volume 2 is Uma Thurman as auteur.
All right.
What about Jackie Brown?
I don't love that one as much as you guys. I like it. But,
no, I know.
It's also, I mean, that one, I guess I probably...
Ensemble as auteur.
Yeah. Inglourious Basterds and that one are a little more communal, I think. Mm-hmm. Like, I really do think that Django and Kill Bill Volume 2, the strength of their lead performances is much of what carries the film. The good thematic conclusions that
Jamie
I take.
Fox rules.
Yeah.
Whereas Jackie Brown is very much an ensemble performance, as good as Pam Grier is in it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The, Robert Forster, so good.
Yeah, those stories too, I think, are more focused on single characters too. Like, they're asked to do a lot more.
Yeah, the revenge tales about a single person getting revenge.
And at least in one case, the whole movie's named after him.
Mm-hmm. Named after him and what happens to him.
Yep.
I killed that dude.
And I got unchained.
You look good.
So, yeah. That's it for me on the organizer.
Yep. Also, shout out to Croatia. Beat England in the World Cup 2-1 in extra time.
Yay!
So it's not going to be a France-England World Cup final, thank God.
Not dueling colonizers?
Go Croatia!
Croatia is one of the funnest country names. It's fun to say. Croatia.
And also the name of the people, the Croats, is really cool too. I like that name.
And shout out to that disco festival that Ilya goes to every year in Croatia.
Hell yeah.
And this is a stolen joke from Mina Kimes, but if France loses, Croatia wins the World Cup, you can say they got Croatia. Stolen valor from Mina Kimes. All right. That's it, right? Ready to wrap this up?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Thanks for listening. I hope you're enjoying the podcast. If so, please subscribe. Using your podcast listening application, give us a 5-star rating and review on iTunes. We really do appreciate it. If you want to go ahead and watch the movie for next week, it's going to be someone we already mentioned, Antonioni's La Notte.
La Notte.
There, yep, snuck
there we go. It's recorded for all history.
And you can check out all of our content on loosecannons.net, including our old podcasts, the ones that iTunes no longer houses. You can still find them on loosecannons.net.
That's right, in the archive section.
Yeah.
Some of them weren't showing up, I think was the problem. So if you have trouble finding one of them, just email us, and I can get you access to them via archive.org.
Goosecannonspodcast@gmail.com.
Yep.
You can email us about anything.
Bam.
Mm-hmm.
And give us money.
Yep.
Patreon.com/loosecannons. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Bye, bye, bye.
Organize.
Yes. Struggle. Fight. Win.